I want to talk for a short time this morning about a subject that many have questions about. Garland followed suit when he saw the title of the lesson this morning. He said, are you going to tell us exactly what that looks like? And to answer that question, no, I won't be telling you exactly what that looks like, unfortunately. I wish I could. You know, as we think about heaven, we think about many of the different things that people associate with heaven. I don't think we talk about heaven nearly enough. You know, I was talking to Zane a while back and I said, Zane, how come nobody talks on heaven? He said, well, I just think there's just not enough material there. You know, as I started studying through it, there's material everywhere on heaven, but it's just bits and pieces. It's hints at certain things. And I think it's because we don't totally have an understanding, nor can we, of what heaven can be. And I think you'll see that as we progress through our study this morning. You know, when I was a young kid, I used to show animals. Didn't particularly like it a whole lot, and I didn't last very long at it. But I did that for a while, and I showed two kind of animals, bad and worse. My animals were always either too fat, and I had to go out after school, and I'd walk them until I could get them down to where they'd make weight, or they were way too skinny, and I had to slop them with some sort of chocolate mixture before school every morning. And that just wasn't that much fun to me. But there's one thing that I remember about showing animals. When you got to that show barn, they had this nice trophy up front. And it was big, and it had a little pig on the top. And it made you want that. And they had a nice belt buckle down below, and you just imagine what that might look like right there on your belt. I remember that. I remember looking at that trophy, thinking how nice it would be to be sitting on my shelf. I never won that trophy. That may be why I didn't do it the whole time. But you know, that was a goal. That was something that we strove for. And that's why they did that. To show that if you work hard and you do certain things, then possibly you can accomplish that. You know, heaven should be the same thing for us. It should be something that we think about on a daily basis. We should remember the sacrifice that was made so that we have the opportunity to strive for that goal. Too many times I think we're more motivated out of fear. Fear that we won't receive that reward. Fear that we'll receive just the opposite. You know, hell's a real place. Too many people don't want to talk about hell. That's not my purpose this morning. It's real. It's something we should fear. But too many times we have something better to look forward to, but we fall back on that fear to motivate us to do what we know we should do, which is serve God. Where does that leave us? You know, I think there's enough studies that have been done on employees. And they say, you know, you look at an employee, you say, well, if you can't get that job done, I'll find somebody that can. Every day I'm on you for that same thing. Can you not just do your job? You know what they say about employers that do that to their employees? Those employees will work just hard enough not to lose their job. Just hard enough. So when we think about using fear as our only motivation to do what God would have us to do, I don't think we're reaching that level what He expects of us. I don't think that drives us to be at the point where He wants us to be. I think it has to be about more than that. So as we work through this, that was really my motivation for putting this study together this morning. To give us something more to strive for, rather than just striving out of fear. Why should we look for something better? In Ecclesiastes 2, there we go. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 11, Solomon said, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Now you think back about Solomon. This was a man that had everything he could possibly want. There was nothing that was out of his reach. He had it all. And what did he say about all of that he had done? All of that he had accomplished. The wealth that he had amassed. What did he say about those things? They were all vanity. Completely worthless. You know, here the writer describes much of what we work for, the pleasures in this life, the things that we attain. They're far less than what Solomon had. Far less. Yet he said what he had was vanity. You know, we look at the Rockefellers or the Gates or the Buffetts or the Carlos Slim or Sunil Bharti Mittal, all of these names that we associate with wealth. If you pick up a magazine that has anything to do with wealth, you're going to see one of these guys in that magazine. And if that's what you want out of life, they can tell you how to get it. But Solomon would be numbered among those names were he here today. And he would tell you those things are worthless. Because one day you're going to come a time and you can't take that with you. It won't take you where you want to go. As he said, at that time, it's all worthless. And it's like grasping at the wind. We know what wind is, don't we? Experienced a little bit of that yesterday. And while that wind may move large objects, if you try to grasp that wind, it's all in vanity. It's a waste of your time. You can't do it. We continue on and we see two individuals. We see a description of what they did and how they were transformed by God and taken up. We'll begin with Enoch in Genesis 5 and 24. And it says, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. By faith. And then again in Hebrews 11 and verse 5, it goes back to reflect on that situation. It says, by faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found, because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had the testimony that he pleased God. You want to talk about success. This guy was successful. What if we came in our last days on our deathbed, and that's what everybody had to say about us? He pleased God. Then you would know you had a successful life, wouldn't you? You would know it at that point. That's what was said about Enoch, that he pleased God. Again, we see another example of Elijah. And it came to pass as they still went on and talked that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Two that were called away. They never experienced death. They were called away. God took them up. Why? We don't exactly know why that was the case. In the case of Enoch, it was done so that he didn't experience death, because he was pleasing to God. In Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 8, we can see where Elijah appears again. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into an high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, is it good for us to be here? If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the clouds which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. We see here that at least one of those came back. Jesus revealed to his apostles here that people can return from the dead. We had Moses there. He'd experienced death. We know he died in the wilderness there and was buried on a high mountain. And Elijah here, who was called up, both of them who returned to give an example to his apostles. You know, Jesus made an impression here. They fell down because they had seen those who had been in heaven. Yet we still see no description of heaven. And why is that? You know, this would have been a great time for Jesus to open up the clouds or whatever the case is and give these guys a glimpse of what heaven might be. But he didn't do it. We don't know why he didn't do it. But we do know that two individuals that had been there were revealed to the apostles at that time. We still have no clear description of what heaven is at this point, though. In Revelations 21, verses 18 through 20, or, excuse me, 18 through 27, we see what most people understand is the only description we're really given of what may be considered to be heaven. In Revelations 21, verse 18, It says, and the building of the wall of it was of jasper, and the city was pure gold and under clear glass. And the foundation of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth an emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, and seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth a topaz, the tenth a chrysoprasus, the 11th a jacinth, the 12th an amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass. And I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it. For the glory of God did light it, and the Lamb is the great light thereof. And the nation of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all day, shut all by day, and there shall be no night there. Remember the song that we sing, and there shall be no night there. That's where this comes from. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it, and there shall in no wise enter into it anything that falleth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination or maketh a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. So that's a lengthy reading there. But when we talk about heaven and when we hear about heaven spoken of out in society, this is the passage that people tend to turn to. And it's a description. It's a very physical description. It's in our terms, in worldly terms. But it even says in this description that it will not be defiled. And when we put it in the terms of pearls and all of these different rare stones and gold, those are all worldly terms. And they're defiled already because they're in the presence of this world. So why would they use this description? Because at that time, if you think back, we have wealth compared to any other time in history in this nation, unmeasurable at any other time. At that time, to hear those things, as magnificent as that sounds to us, it's probably of a factor of 10 to these guys at this time. To hear something that amazing described to them in terms that they may understand, something so far greater than anything they've ever seen, it's put into those terms. But I don't think that's an accurate description of heaven. I don't think that heaven has all of these things that we experience in life, that we have on this world. I think the experience we will see in heaven is far, far greater than anything we see here. Many, I believe, this is a true description of heaven, but I don't believe that's right. Verse 27 says, nothing shall enter in that should defile it, yet the things described of the world here are defiled already. Pearls and things of this nature, they perish, they fade away. Heaven will never fade away. It's something we'll experience forever. So what will be there? In 1 Corinthians 15, verses 52 through 53, it says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal shall put on immortality. You know, this verse many times is used to suggest, you know, we're going to get another physical body. It's going to be a different physical body. I don't think Scripture supports that. I think we'll be changed. Most certainly will be changed. But again, we try to put those in terms that we understand. A new physical body. In Philippians 3 and verse 21, it says, who shall change our vile body that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. By his glorious body will be reflected in him. You know, that's not a physical body. In John 4 and verse 24, it says, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. That's not a physical body. And I don't think we're going to receive an additional physical body. I think God is a spirit, and we will somehow dwell with him in that spiritual realm. In 1 Peter 4, verses 4 through 5, excuse me, 1 Peter 1, verses 4 through 5, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. You know, part verse 5 is very interesting because it talks about this inheritance ready to be revealed in the last time. You know, we had all the teachings that we have in God's Word, but this says that's going to be revealed at that time. Why didn't we just reveal it in the passages that we see? I think it's because we can't fully comprehend what that's going to be like, and it will be revealed to us at that time. You know, the things on this earth, as we said, are corrupted. And when we think about physical things being in heaven, or when we put those things there in our minds, we're adding corruption to something incorruptible. And I think if we remember that when we think about different questions that come up about heaven, you'll get a lot of different questions. What are we going to see when we get there? You know, are my pets going to be there? These types of things. I don't know the answer to those questions, but I think when we put corrupt things into an incorruptible place, those two don't match. So if we remember those two things, corrupt things that waste away won't be there, and in a moment we'll see things that we will not remember. And I think when we think about those two points, it makes it more clear the questions, a lot of the questions that we get asked or that we ask ourselves about what we'll see when we get there. In Matthew 6, verses 19 and 20, it says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth or rust doth rust destroy, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break through and steal." You know, it tells us that's where we should be putting all our time. That's where we should be putting all of our focus, is on something that can't be corrupted, something that can't be stolen. If you think about all the wonderful things that we may see in this life, you know, we think about buying a home and how great that is. You know, over time, that home decays. It goes away. You know, we buy this great new car, and the day that we buy, it's a great day, but it won't last forever. Something that costs that much in our lives, and it slowly decays away. Everything in this life is that way. Everything that we have in this life can be taken from us. Even if we get down to our health, the health of this physical body, that can be taken from us in an instant. Everything in this world can waste away. But heaven's not that way. In John 14, verses 2 through 4, it says, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know." He goes to prepare a mansion. A large, impressive house is what we would consider to be a mansion. So as he's describing this situation to these people, why would he use a physical thing if he's trying to describe heaven to them? He's putting it into the terms they understand. A large, impressive place. And when we think about, if he told us there was a dwelling that I'm going to create for you, and it's going to be so magnificent that your mind can't even understand it. In our minds, if we would thought of a dwelling with all these different things, we would probably picture a mansion, wouldn't we? I think he was putting it into their terms. Some would tell us there was a dwelling equipped with everything we could imagine. Some form of mansion would probably enter our minds, and that's what we would picture in our minds, because we put it into our terms when we think about things like that. In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 1, it says, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heaven." So we're back to that again. It's not made with hands. It's not something physical. And so when it seems like we're flip-flopping back and forth, and one minute it's talking about all these physical great things that we're going to possess, and on the other hand it's on these things we can't comprehend, I think that's why it does that. Because we can't comprehend it. And so it's put into terms, or these individuals put into terms, that they can't understand. You know, there's two verses that give us a glimpse of what our existence will be like. In Psalm 16 and verse 11, it says, "You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." You know, that's the things that we can understand. That there is joy forevermore. Not the problems that we have in this life. Not the issues that we deal with on a daily basis. But joy. joy in that place and pleasures in His right hand. In Hebrews 4, verses 9 and 10, it says, "There remains therefore rest for the people of God, for He who has entered in His rest has Himself also ceased from His works, as God did from His." It's called a place of rest. And when we think about this, and we think about every day when we get up in the morning, we decide, are we going to go be with, are we going to serve God, or are we going to go with the world? We fight that fight every day. We make a choice. Are we going to stand for what's right, or are we going to fall to the world? And we fight that fight, and we fight it every day, and we grow tired, don't we? We get tired of being faced with those things. This is described as a time of rest, where we can overcome those things, and we won't be faced by those things any longer. You know, there's also there a reference to the creation where God did also rest. And that shows us the side that He understands, that the things we do in this life, they take a toll on us. And just as He rested on that last day, we will rest when we finally reach that goal. So what will not be there when we reach heaven? In Isaiah 65 and verse 17, it says, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind." We'll no longer remember the shortcomings and disappointments and the losses of this world. All the things that make us question why we're here, those will be gone. We won't have the heartache. We won't experience the loss of those, our loved ones. Those things that are so hard and make it so hard to live in this life will be gone. And we won't experience them anymore. In Revelation 21 and 4, it says, God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Everything that we don't like about this world, everything that causes us grief in this world, causes us pain and loss and sorrow, all of those things will pass away to be remembered no more. How great would that be? If it were nothing else, if we were there at that time not to deal with any of these things any longer. No more financial issues, no more health issues, no more pain, no more loss of loved ones. All of those things were gone. How great would that be? Yet we know that it promises even more than that. We also know the wicked will be excluded. Going back to having no defiled thing or no corruptible thing in this incorruptible place. You know, those individuals will be excluded. In Galatians 5 and 21, it says, "Envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." Nothing defiled will be there, including these individuals. In 2 Peter 3 and verse 13, it says, "Nevertheless, we, according to His promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." Righteousness dwells. That's what will be there. God is righteous, and everything that in heaven will reflect Him in that righteousness. You know, if you look at the flip side, which would be hell, that's not our purpose this morning, but if we consider that just for a second, if we contrast the two, what would we see there? Complete absence of God. No peace. No peace whatsoever. You know, I worked with a guy, and he was in the military, and he would tell us stories about the things that they did there. And one of the things that they did to break their sleep patterns, they would go out and they would do all sorts of physical training. And then they'd put them in this room with all of these bright lights, is the way he described it. Then every time it looked like you were going to doze off, somebody would walk by and just kind of kick you in the leg, wake you up. And you're there for a little bit longer. And as you laid there, you might start to doze off again and somebody would kick you in the leg again. And he said they would stay in these rooms for hours with these guys doing it to them. You know, I think hell might be somewhat like that. Every time you start to get just a little bit of pleasure, just a little bit of relief from what's ailing you, it's taken from you. And God's not there. A total absence of God in your life. That's the flip side of what we talk about this morning. You know, it can't be put into terms we think of in this life. We just can't comprehend it in that way. And that's why I think people get so confused, because they read on one page and they see these physical things. And then they look on another and it says it's not made with hands. It's incorruptible. And so there's confusion surrounding that. But I think there's one verse that settles it in my mind why I think this to be true. If we look in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 9, and I don't know about this translation, I don't know where it comes from, but I thought the translation goes right along with the verse, and I thought it did a really good job of explaining what it says. In 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 9, it says, "What God has planned for people who love Him is more than eyes have seen or ears have heard. It has never entered into their minds." Something so magnificent, it's never entered into our minds. We've seen a lot of things. We've seen a lot of wealth. You know, there's a TV show on, a show on TV right now that probably turn your stomach, because just the way that they treat wealth and the way that they look at it. I think it's called, Secret Lives of the Rich, I can't remember. It's one of those shows where they show a lot of stuff that I'll never have. But you look at this, and they break out just liquors that cost, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, handbags that cost $200,000-$300,000, and these people have just closets full of them. Cars that are $1 million, homes that are $500 million. We've seen those things. We may not have ever owned any of them, but we know they exist. And this is so far in advance of that. Our minds can't comprehend it, I don't think. And just as it says here, it's never entered into our minds. So if Jesus would have come to the apostles and said, "This is exactly what you're going to see," I don't think they would have understood it. I think if we read about that description, I don't think we would have understood it. And so it's put into terms that they could understand. It's so magnificent. It's filled with these things that you consider to have value. I think that's why it describes it that way. You know, I think we have a slight example of this in how we view other cultures. When we view other cultures, we don't totally understand why they do what they do, do we? And when we have a problem, where we have a problem is where we start trying to put that into our terms. I'll give you an example. You know, when Sean comes back and he shows us these pictures of Nigeria, and these people come to church and their clothes are so flamboyant. They're bright, bright colors. Everybody always asks the same thing. Why are they dressed that way? In their culture, that's what they like. They like those colors. Now in Wheeler, Texas, if the community saw us come in dressed like that, they'd think we were having a circus. So when you look at that and you look at their culture, something there that they value, something that they think is appropriate to do, there's nothing wrong with that. That's how their culture is, and that's perfectly normal for them. But we put it into our terms, and we think that's something totally out of our minds, something that we would never do that way. So when we view other cultures, I think it gives us a small glimpse of what we tend to do in our minds when things are described to us. Why do they wear those colors like that? Is there something going on there? Something different that they're doing there? No. It's just another day of them going to worship clothed in the way that they would choose to be clothed. It's pretty simple. But in our minds, we change that. We make it fit what we think. And I think there's a lot of truth to that when we look at heaven. It's never entered into our minds how wonderful it'll be. And for that reason, I think there's confusion over how it's described, what's there, and how it will be. There's no misunderstandings on what will be there. God will be there. Jesus will be there on His right hand with all of the pleasures that it talks about, with all of the joy that it talks about. And it will be uncorrupted and untouched by the things of this world.